Tony Perrottet doesn't care what a place is called, as long as it's far away. In fact, Perrottet used to be a travel snob. Instead of going to Paris or the Bahamas, he went to Tierra del Fuego and the Amazon rainforest. And then he discovered the oldest surviving guidebook at the New York Public Library. It was Roman, and it launched Perrottet on his most exotic journey yet. He decided to follow in the footsteps of the ancient Romans, those footsteps that led to the same places that hordes of tourists visit today, the Colosseum, Athens, the Parthenon. Perrottet writes about his travels in the book called Pagan Holiday. He told Steve Paulson that nothing's really changed since the Romans invented tourism.
Literature has a litany of complaints about inns in ancient times, about their rock-hard mattresses and their leaky roofs and the staff who are sullen and surly and the innkeepers who are demented. And at all these places, you could also get food as well. There were little restaurants in all these inns. And much like today, people would complain about the food. There were always rumours of human flesh turning up in the stews and knuckle bones and things like that. And in fact, the people who stayed in these inns as well, there was Plutarch is always complaining about the company that you would find yourself stuck with at night, and he actually advises that you hum to yourself in the dining room to drown out the drivel of the other travellers.
So once you actually started to read about all of this stuff, you did something rather unusual. You retraced the route of these ancient Roman tourists. So why did you want to do that?
I'd always loved ancient history, and I had studied Latin and Greek back in Australia, where I was brought up, and I had actually intended to go, naturally, to see the great sites of Italy and Greece and Asia Minor in Egypt. But when I left Australia, I made it as far as India, and it was so fascinating and so amazing and so cheap that I ended up staying for months. And I began to see the Mediterranean as a place that had been so overrun by tourists since the 1960s. In the modern world, that's the place where everyone was going. It felt like it was expensive and overrun, and there was nothing new or fresh that I could see there. So I actually kept putting it off. And as a writer, my specialty became going to remote and exotic places. I lived in South America. I used to go to Zanzibar and all these places, and I realised at a certain point that I'd been to Tierra del Fuego 5 times, but I still hadn't been to Rome. So it was starting to seem kind of pathological, this avoidance of the Mediterranean. So once I found all this information, I thought, what an incredible way to see the Mediterranean in a fresh way, looking at it through the eyes of the ancient tourists, and in fact going to all these places that were in fact identified as tourist sites first by the ancient Romans. Many of the things that we regard as fascinating now is the Romans who first wanted to go to the site of Troy or to see Olympia and Corinth and Delphi and to hang around the Bay of Naples and to go to Capri. So I found that very inspiring. It was just an unusual and new way of seeing the Mediterranean.
What was the general route that you took?
Exactly following the greatest hits of the Romans, really, which is really, if you were doing a Wonders of the Mediterranean tour today, it's very similar. They started off in Rome, obviously, and then it was a very easy run along the Via Appia down to the Bay of Naples, which was the first great seaside resort of antiquity, and that was where the beautiful villas were, and that was where it was very sensual and hedonistic lifestyle. It was the first real association of sun, sand, and sex. Everyone would just hang there for the summer, and they would eat an incipient form of bouillabaisse by the water and swim in these beautiful little bays, protected bays that they built. From there, they would then go to Greece, which was kind of like the old world for the Romans, and that was where the source of all civilization and culture was. They admired the Greeks terribly, and educated Romans, you know, all spoke Greek, and they had been brought up reading Homer and all the greats of, for them, antiquity. And so they would start off in Athens, where the philosophers had all lived and spoken, and they would go to the Academy of Plato, and they'd go to Socrates' birthplace and things like that. They would go to Delphi, where the oracle of Apollo had been. And then they would cut across the Aegean, hopping in merchant ships, much as we sort of go on these little Greek ferries today. And they would go over to the coast of Asia Minor, which is now Turkey, going via Rhodes, where the Colossus of Rhodes had actually fallen. And it had actually fallen not long after it had been built, but the goal was to go to Troy. And for Romans, that was like the Jerusalem of ancient times. They, having read Homer, they loved to go to the site where all this had occurred, and they could actually, there were little battlefield tours where people would show them around, where all the events had occurred, where Zeus had come down, or where some of a god had intervened, where, you know, Priam had fallen, where, you know, Achilles had chased Hector around the walls and things like that.
And that was all, I suppose, very real real history for them. I mean, this was just some ancient mythological kind of site that they were visiting.
No, absolutely, absolutely. There was very little distinction made between history and mythology. It all blurred and overlapped. And to actually be on this place that they'd read about since childhood was an extraordinary thing for them. And they would go around and they would carry their copies of Homer, and most of them actually knew it all by heart. So they would be wandering around having these epiphanies and... But anyway, from Troy, they would head down to Egypt, and Egypt was very unusual and it was incredibly exotic. Mostly Romans weren't that interested in other cultures. They thought the Greco-Roman culture was the best and didn't really consider like the other cultures of Asia Minor. But Egypt, ever since the Greek times, it was just so undeniably ancient and so undeniably bizarre that it was an ongoing fascination for Romans, and especially those of a philosophical bent. But there you would hire guides and you would arrange a Nile cruise, basically. And from Alexandria, you could just go up to the pyramids, which had fascinated people since Herodotus. In those days, they were much more splendid than they are now. They were still covered with the limestone coping that was there. It was removed by the Arabs in the 6th century AD. But quite an extraordinary sight. They would rise on the horizon like this trio of icebergs or something out of the sand. And it would be covered with hieroglyphics as well. And when you were there, the shaven-headed priests of Egypt would go wander around. And they'd tell the same sort of bizarre stories that they still tell today. They would be going on about how the pyramids went down into the sand as far as they went up. They would say that one of the pyramids had been financed by the pharaoh prostituting his daughter out. All these sorts of bizarre stories are just passed on.
Now, I got the impression as I was reading your book that sex was a fairly big draw for a lot of these tourists, that for some, they clearly wanted to indulge, and there were places that were famous as erotic hotspots, I guess. But also, I guess people wanted to see erotic art.
Definitely. I think sex and travel have always been intertwined, actually. And for the Romans, who were a little bit sexually obsessed, it very much was so. And the Bay of Naples was probably the most famous of the places to go, especially in summer, which was quite convenient because it was very close to Rome. And you could go there and, for example, if you visited the Villa of Tiberius, you could go up there and there would be tours showing around. They're showing the paintings from Elephantus that were on his walls, these erotic paintings, and hear about the Sprintrii, who were his adepts at unnatural practices, and he used to swim in his pools there, and little boys would dress up as minnows, and according to Suetonius, they would swim with him and nibble at his parts as he swam around. But very much so, erotic art was very important, and one of the great erotic pieces was the Aphrodite of Cnidos, which was over in the coast of Asia Minor, and that was one of the great ones to go to. It was actually the first female nude ever done. So people would go to this port, Cnidos, which had very little else to recommend it except that it had this rather exciting statue, and it would be a great process going there. It was in the Temple of Aphrodite, and you would go in there and speak to the priests, and you would have some wine, and then you would be shown the image, and then after you'd discussed with the guide there, if you were, had got on well with, in many cases it was an elderly lady, she would take out a key and show the rear view. So you would gaze upon the posterior of Aphrodite.
So is this erotic art still on display? Did you see a lot of these things that you're describing?
There's copies of the Aphrodite of Cnidos. The actual original, like almost all Greek statues, has disappeared, and the fragments of various things are around. The most erotic art is really in the brothels of Pompeii. Have some very, very interesting pieces, actually. They because this wasn't for the upper classes, but in the brothels they had the little stalls that the women worked in. Above each one was a little painting showing the prostitute's speciality, and those are still there, and they're the most popular things to see in Pompeii. In fact, there's this logjam of people trying to get in and out, jabbering on in all languages, discussing these images. So sex still sells.
Now, you did something that no ancient Roman tourist could do. You actually did some underwater tourism, investigating some ruins, right?
It's true. In the Bay of Naples in Baiae, which was possibly the most luxurious and depraved of all the seaside resorts. It was a bathhouse that was famous for its scenes of debauchery and bacchanals. It had sort of disappeared because of the seismic activity there. It had actually sunk under the water. So in recent years, just in the last 10, 15 years, Italian archaeologists have been diving there and finding all sorts of extraordinary things. And one little company, an Italian company, started up doing dives. not really warning people, although I should have known that the Bay of Naples is the most polluted corner of the Mediterranean. So I sort of signed up in the middle of a storm. We went out there and jumped in, and the diving equipment was actually less than perfect. I was taking mouthfuls of this glutinous water while I was going down there. It was quite a disgusting experience in many ways.
Were you actually using scuba equipment?
Yes. Yeah, no, it's... You have to go down, it's about 40 foot down to see some of the blocks, which are the base of a lighthouse that was there. And then you drift over in slightly shallower waters, and there are actual mosaics from the bottoms of some of the villas there. And to see that, you know, it was one of the most extraordinary experiences. It's as if you've come across Atlantis or something like that. It's just, there's something I think about how difficult it is to see something that makes it seem more rewarding. And it also gets your imagination going in a way that's far more vivid than if you've stumbled across it in the middle of a very crowded site in Italy. So, yeah, that was one of the most vivid experiences of the trip, possibly because it was so disgusting. You know, it was like you're incredibly alert. Every sense is attuned to what's going on, because the rest of it is like, it's covered in all sorts of garbage and, you know, the sunken petrol cans, and everything is just, it's just covered in all sorts of filth and grime down there. But when you see these beautiful little gems, it feels like you're very privileged to see it.
Well, did you feel that the world that you were experiencing was anything like the world that these ancient Roman tourists would have seen 2,000 years ago?
Well, I think that the archetypal experiences of travel haven't changed. The technology has, and the physical condition of the sites has obviously changed. But I found that when you ended up in these very unlikely situations, you can sort of have these connections back to the past. And they would tend to be more improbable ones, like diving in the Bay of Naples, where you could never really recommend that to anybody, but you have these strange sort of connections. Or when we were lost in the, you know, the mountains of Arcadia, and you're surrounded by mist, and you would basically be seeing exactly what the Romans would have seen. Or in Egypt as well. Egypt is quite an extraordinary place, because what the Romans saw in the 1st and 2nd century ADs, with some exceptions, was very much what we see today. The ruins of Luxor are very much the same now as they were then. The Sphinx, the condition of the Sphinx. The pyramids are still as amazing now as they were then. There's 90 or so pyramids. There's one that still has its limestone coping. It's called the Bent Pyramid. That's quite an extraordinary experience, because when you go out there, it takes a few hours driving through the desert. Nothing around. It's just like barren to the horizon all around. And then it just rises from the road as you're coming down this valley. And it's quite an incredible experience. And even though we were not on camelback, or we weren't doing exactly the same sort of Nile cruise, you can still have that imaginative leap and realize or get a feeling for how ancient Roman sightseers, who were, after all, interested in the same things that we were, how it must have been very similar for them.
Tony Perrottet is the author of Pagan Holiday. Steve Paulson spoke with him.